Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is institutional arrangements. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. I apologize to those who did log in a little bit early. We're a little late getting started off with the introductions, but we'll definitely be able to make up the time. Today we'll have three presentations given by Michael Williamson of Cambridge Systematics, Bruce McDowell of the National Academy of Public Administration, and David Seltzer of Mercator Advisors. Ed Stracco of the Federal Highway Administration Office of Freight Management and Operations will be giving a brief introduction to Bruce's presentation. Michael Williamson is a principal of Cambridge Systematics with over 16 years of experience in the areas of freight and intermodal planning, commercial vehicle operations, intelligent transportation systems, and transportation planning. He has worked extensively with metropolitan planning organizations, state departments of transportation, and federal agencies to assist them in the development of freight programs. He recently served as the principal investigator for the National Cooperative Freight Research Program, or NCFRP, Project 9, Institutional Arrangements in the Freight Transportation System. This project resulted in a set of guidelines designed to facilitate the development of successful freight institutional arrangements. He also serves as Cambridge Systematics Regional Planning Manager for Florida. Ed Stracco is a transportation specialist in the Federal Highway Administration's Office of Freight Management and Operations. He focuses on freight transportation infrastructure projects, freight policy, economics, and finance to support FHWA, state DOTs, and MPOs in implementing programs to improve freight operations within the country's transportation network. Dr. Bruce McDowell has over 50 years of professional experience as a local and regional planner, a federal executive, and a planning and management consultant. He retired from the U.S. Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations in 1996 when Congress abolished it, and has been a leading project director at the National Academy of Public Administration ever since. He also has his own active private consulting practice, Intergovernmental Management Associates. Dr. McDowell has extensive experience with transportation studies as a public official, a nonprofit researcher, a private consultant, and a longtime member of several transportation research board committees. David Seltzer is a principal and co-founder of Mercator Advisors, a Philadelphia-based financial advisory firm consulting to governmental, corporate, and nonprofit organization sponsors of major infrastructure projects and programs. He has over 30 years of experience in the field of public and project finance, working in both governmental and private sectors. Mr. Seltzer previously served as senior advisor to the Federal Highway Administrator from 1996 to 1999, and was actively involved in designing and executing new financial assistance programs such as TIFIA, a federal loan and guarantee program under the T21 authorizing legislation. Before joining USDOT, he spent 20 years in investment banking and assembled public and project financings for transportation and other infrastructure programs at Lazard Frere and Lehman Brothers. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type them into the chat area on the right side of your screen. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and a great forum for the distribution of information, as well as a place where you can post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you haven't already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I'd like to remind you the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used today are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen and will also be posted online. I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript of the seminar. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is institutional arrangements, and our first presentation will be given by Michael Williamson of Cambridge Systematics. As a reminder, if you have any questions, please type them into the chat box and we'll get to them in the last half hour of the seminar. So with that, Mike, I'm going to bring up your presentation, if you give me just a second.
All set?
Okay, you can go ahead and get started.
All right, thanks, Jennifer. Today I'm going to give you a fairly high-level overview of the project that was recently completed for the National Cooperative Freight Research Program. In fact, I believe it's the first program, the first project out of that program since it was created to actually be completed. It's currently being edited for distribution today. Before we get started, I'd just like to take a moment or two to acknowledge the panel that we had for this project, including Dave Ganofsky, who was formerly with the Maryland DOT. He's on the line here today as well to assist with any of the questions that folks might have at the end. Just to kind of acknowledge, if you look down through this list, you'll see that we had quite a mix of state, federal, academic, association, lobbyists, local governments. We had a lot of folks that were really providing some very good input as we move forward with this project. And I know several of them are on the phone today as well. So the purpose for the project, as defined by the statement of work, really was to describe successful and promising institutional arrangements that help improve freight movement, both what works well today as well as what we believe we're going to need in the future based on some of the shifts in global transportation and some of the increasing challenges in our national transportation system. So our work plan was designed basically to describe what works well today, convert that input into a resource guide to help a full range of public and private partners, both transportation agencies as well as industry representatives, to put together new institutional arrangements or modify the arrangements that they already have in place, and ultimately to define an implementation plan to help get this information out to folks. And certainly our participation in today's Talking Freight seminar is one of the first steps in meeting that last objective. Before we got started, we felt it was important to define exactly what a freight institutional arrangement is. We came up with a term a definition that encompasses most of what folks are doing out there today. It was defined as a structured foundation that enables relevant parties to advance the general interests of freight mobility, cutting across all the major functional areas, including infrastructure, operations, services, and regulations, and also the particular focus on programs or projects that are specifically to help increase freight mobility, whether it be at a local, regional, or national level. Our research elements included data collection, where we went out and did a literature review of some of the best examples of institutional arrangements that are out there today. We held a stakeholder workshop at the Beckman Center in Irvine, where we got about 65 folks out there to spend two days with us helping define what the key needs were and how to go about developing a resource document that would be useful. And then we conducted a series of follow-up, fairly intensive interviews to develop 16 detailed case studies, which ultimately were used to define guidelines or guideline recommendations. We've grouped the institutional arrangements into three different types, and we've developed guidelines to address each of those types of arrangements. And we've also used the TRB's annual meeting earlier this year to test some of what we had and get some final input before finalizing our document. As we began trying to document what's done well, we did a quick assessment on kind of what works and what doesn't, and we found among the strengths that exist today, certainly there's been a lot of success in integrating freight into the policy planning and programming activities that transportation agencies are undertaking. That's being done successfully through a variety of advisory committees and task forces, groups of public and private stakeholders that are getting together in many cases annually or more frequently than that to help MPOs, as an example, put together their long-range plan and updates. Also, the ability to facilitate project prioritization and completion. There are several examples out there I know that I have a few acronyms that will be defined as we move forward, but programs like FSTED and FIMSIB. FSTED is the Florida Seaport Transportation and Economic Development Council, which is a group of seaport directors and state agencies that allocate state funds across a variety of seaport projects on an annual basis. And we have the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board in Washington State, which also brings together public and private partners specifically to select, fund, and monitor transportation improvements to benefit freight transportation. So there are certainly examples of that out there. Improving overall operational efficiency of freight movements, we have some examples such as the Pier Pass program in Southern California. Improving information dissemination and education, I think that's one of the things MPO states, conferences, and the federal government have done a fairly good job at doing, and again, this is a perfect example of that. A few other strengths include promoting multi-jurisdictional solutions. There's quite a lot of success out there with programs like the I-95 Corridor Coalition as far as putting together and identifying what the needs are. Coming up with ways to program and invest in and fund the improvements is where there tends to be more of a challenge. Forming project-specific operating authorities like the Alameda Corridor Transportation Authority, which certainly is probably the largest example of that in the United States. Not done too often, but there are examples of it being done successfully. Leveraging public and private funding opportunities, bringing public and private partners together to actually invest in infrastructure to leverage each other's ability, and promoting freight system needs as a whole through the lobbying and association community. We also found that there are, at kind of the highest level, there's three kind of basic weaknesses that are really challenges to putting institutional arrangements in place. Lack of a mandate to do so within whichever environment you are, whether you're public or private sector. A mismatch of scope. We all know freight transportation really covers multi-jurisdictional areas, whether it's multiple urban areas, multiple states, multiple countries, and being able to bring the right group of people together is often a challenge. And of course, insufficient funding. So we took that information, we took the literature review that we did in kind of a national canvas of what's out there and what works, and we developed a classification scheme that looked across, if you look at the left-hand side of these scales, we have an issue scale, a function scale, and a legal structure. And we were trying to determine whether or not commonly grouped arrangements behaved the same. And when you look at the issue, you could be a gateway, you could be a metro area, state, corridor, multi-state. And when you look at the function of the arrangement, it could cover anywhere from advocacy to research to operations and capital improvements. And a legal structure, you have a variety there as well, whether it's an authority, an agency, a private firm, or not-for-profit. And the example you see here is for C-Vision, and it shows that C-Vision, which is the Commercial Vehicle Information Systems and Networks Program, is a multi-state program. It's really national for all of the states that are choosing to compete. It deals with regulation and operations, and it's a public agency as far as the lead agency. But it partners with other public sector agencies as well as industry. And for those of you who are not familiar with C-Vision, it's a program that's provided a framework for organizing, funding, and deploying technology to automate both regulatory desk-side and commercial vehicle operations as well as safety enforcement at the roadside. It brings together state, federal, and private sector partners and really has provided an opportunity to create a national architecture for commercial vehicle operations. So we looked across the types of arrangements out there and we grouped them, as I mentioned, into three. The first type focuses on increasing the visibility and importance of freight issues and policies. The second type takes and builds upon that to develop consensus on actual project priorities, different types of improvements, and may actually get involved in ranking projects and allocating funds. And then type three, which is a little bit less frequent in the United States, is responsible for designing, mitigating, constructing, operating some type of a new system. And when you look at the types of activities that fall within each of these types, it helps you understand where a particular arrangement would fit. Under type one, we're focused on information sharing, consensus building, setting your policies, increasing visibility of freight transportation. When you move into type two, you're more focused on evaluation, prioritization, leveraging of funds. And when you get to type three, you get very specific as far as all the steps you have to go through to make a project actually happen: design, construction, environmental mitigation, etc. In order to illustrate those types and to actually develop specific guidelines, we went through and did a 16 case studies, as I mentioned. And you can see here, the majority of them fall in type one. That is the most common type of arrangement in the United States today. And they range from regional task forces to multi-state coalitions to economic development type initiatives like the Kansas City Smart Port. If you look at type two, we're looking at where you're actually programming funding like the FSTED program and FIMSIB, which I already mentioned. Maine DOT has an industrial rail access program that looks to provide state funding to facilitate private sector investment in the rail transportation system. And when you get down to type three, that's when you really start focusing on projects that are going through detailed protocols and procedures like the Alameda Corridor or the CREATE program, the Chicago Regional Environmental and Transportation Efficiency Program. So based on those case studies, we developed a series of guidelines, and we grouped those by type as well. The types correspond to the types of arrangements. When you look at the types of guidelines, type one, really focusing on getting your program established, defining your goals and objectives, what you're trying to accomplish, bringing the right group of stakeholders together, and building some consensus and common mission. When you get to a type two set of guidelines, they're really focusing on identifying what your needs are, prioritizing your projects, and then funding them. And type three, again, is more focused on the implementation, whether it be design, construction, or operations. And I want to point out that each of these builds on each other. You may have a type one that was created to be a type one and will forever remain a type one, or you may have a type one that in its early stages was type one, and as it evolved over multiple years, based on what its mission was, can type three. So type one guidelines, I'm not going to go through all of these in general or in detail, but the type one guidelines, again, they focus on identifying the need and purpose of your arrangement, the forming your strategies, figuring out who's going to be your champion, who makes sure that progress is made over time, putting together your partnerships with your fellow stakeholders, consensus-based process, short and long-term progress, having performance measures, and encouraging some cost sharing. And an example of a type one would be the I-95 Corridor Coalition, which is a multi-state coalition designed to identify and solve multi-state transportation problems, particularly in this case, the ones we care about is their intermodal track, which looks specifically at freight transportation needs across multi-states. When you look at the type two guidelines, again, they're focused on defining program elements and implementation processes. What's the appropriate set of protocols, voting structures, approval processes, evaluation criteria for ranking your projects. It could include project audits, site visits, and ensuring that you're making progress over time into achieving your mission. And an example here, again, would be the Florida Seaport Transportation and Economic Development Program, which again was created by the Florida legislature back in 1991 to help ensure that Florida's investments in its seaports were creating a public benefit and were being invested in projects that made sense for both the state and the seaport. It's a 50-50 match through grants and bonds, and it's provided the state with an opportunity to look more at a system level as opposed to port by port. Finally, our type three guidelines, you'll see there's a few more here, and that's illustrative of the fact that we're talking about very specific actions. We're talking about champions. We're talking about a forum for a neutral broker. We're talking about mitigation strategies, whether it be environmental or traffic. Establishing clear decision-making authority. Adopting a product orientation. You're not just developing policies and plans anymore. You're actually implementing and constructing projects. So you have to negotiate your third-party agreements. You have to establish funding firewalls and look at bond rating agencies. So it gets very specific in what you're trying to accomplish when you get to a Type 3. And the example we've got here today for that would be the CREATE program in Chicago, which is bringing together public and private sector stakeholders to invest in key bottlenecks in the rail system in the greater Chicago area, which, as we all know, serves as a major rail freight hub for the United States. So there's a lot more detail that's hard to go over in a PowerPoint presentation that describes exactly how you would use and implement those guidelines. But we also wanted to provide a few thoughts on what some of the first steps are as far as getting started. And they in large part mimic some of the first Type 1 guidelines. And in order to really get started with an institutional arrangement, you need to have a leader or a champion that's going to step forward. Looking at who's logged on today, I know many of you represent very successful freight institutional arrangements today, and I would imagine you would agree with the fact that if you don't have that personal commitment of an agency or, more to the point, of an individual, it's very hard to keep a program together over time. It's also important to bring together the right group of stakeholders. And you really need to do that before you set all your objectives and goals. You might have a problem statement that you're trying to address, but you really need to get the right group of stakeholders together so that they can help you define your specific missions and objectives and goals in the direction that you're going to take. And that can be done through an open forum where you identify the specific needs, you get folks to talk about the opportunities and challenges that are facing the group, and again, draft the purpose of what the institutional arrangement is going to accomplish. Once you have that accomplished, then you can develop your action plan, which really would be looking at the type, from the perspective of this resource, you'd look at the types of guidelines that exist, the types of things you're trying to accomplish. You can look through some very detailed case studies that illustrate the use of those guidelines, and put together an action plan that addresses your needs in the short term, with the understanding that you're probably going to be evolving over time. As I mentioned, this project is currently has been submitted to the Transportation Research Board. It is being edited by their editing department, and it releases anticipated late this year or certainly early 2010, based on how long that process takes. Bill Rogers, who is our contact with the NCFRP, National Cooperative Freight Research Program within TRB, can certainly be contacted with additional questions, as can I. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Again, I want to encourage you, if you have any questions for Mike, please type them into the chat area, and if you could also indicate that your question is for Mike so that when we get to the end, it's easy to keep track of which presenter they are for. We're now going to move on to Ed Stracco of the FHWA Office of Freight Management and Operations, who will give a brief introduction before we move on to Bruce McDowell of the National Academy of Public Administration. So, Ed, I'll bring this up. Do you want me to flip through for you? Okay.
Thanks, Jennifer. Today, Bruce McDowell is going to present the results of the work he completed for the Federal Highway Administration and the I-95 Corridor Coalition. His work was focused on analyzing multi-state institutions that states, MPOs, and others can employ when implementing freight movement projects. I want to give you a little bit of our thinking on why we asked Bruce to undertake this work. Some of the recent discussions of freight transportation have assumed that there are going to be high growth rates of freight volume, and that's going to continue. But whether the high growth rates return with the economic recovery or are they replaced by very modest growth, there are a number of issues that are going to be the same. First, freight transportation is already a significant contributor to congestion and should be accommodated more effectively. Second, as the economy evolves, freight transportation will need to keep pace with the changes in the type, time requirements, and the geographic distribution of goods needed by businesses and households. Third, as you can see on the slide, unless capacity is expanded at key locations, freight movements will be subject to increased delay and decreased reliability, which will disrupt the logistical systems and increase cost of American businesses and be to the detriment of our global competitiveness and economic productivity. On this slide, I want you to note the section of the pies that are in red. This is the through ton miles of truck shipments. We know that the freight transportation system that supports the economy rarely stays within political boundaries. Substantial freight moves between places separated by multiple states. We see a large percentage of the value and tonnage of freight moving across state, regional, or national boundaries, such as on this slide. For those who really like empirical data, we had Crystal Jones from our office pull some of the data out of her FPM. The data in this program comes from 500,000 trucks with GPS. We put a geofence around Dallas and captured 3,000 trucks originating from Dallas on a single day. The map you see shows you where those trucks went over the next 10 days. It's a bit beyond just the Texas border. The next slide shows major freight corridors based on the freight volumes on highways, rail, and water. We know that federal legislation established MPOs years ago to coordinate transportation planning and investment across state and local lines within urban areas. However, the freight corridors usually extend well beyond even the largest metropolitan regions and often involve several states. MPOs typically lack the geographic reach and the ability to finance and implement projects that are needed to serve freight movements from and to distant locations. So we've seen several multi-state coalitions formed to study the transportation problems of freight corridors and recommend solutions for these. Groups like I-95 and the MAROPS study, one good example. We see the first generation of the multi-state coalitions have really gained success by coming together to study the issues and to plan for the potential transportation projects. But we've also seen as the coalitions have matured and moved towards project implementation, there's been a struggle to find effective mechanisms to administer, fund, manage the large multi-state capital transportation projects that are needed. So we think to evolve into effective organizations to implement and finance projects across state lines that the corridor coalitions, state DOTs, MPOs, and ourselves at USDOT need to build on the expertise gained from others out there in transportation and other sectors of the economy, such as energy transmission and some of the institutional arrangements that they've had. So with that said, FHWA wanted to better understand what the spectrum of arrangements and structures that can be employed to administer and fund these multi-state transportation projects. We see this work as a background piece to help the practitioners and the policymakers think through solution sets. We really don't see this as a decision document or one recommendation for a specific institutional mechanism. We don't think there's a silver bullet. There's no one-size-fits-all. There are going to be different solutions that are going to be applicable for different projects. And our real intent was to present a series of options to folks like you and other agencies who are faced with decisions on which path they want to pursue. So with that, I want to turn it over to Bruce to talk about the results of what he's done.
Thank you, Ed. I think Ed's really pretty much explained this page that's on the screen right now. The purpose is to take a broad scan at interstate institutions, multi-state institutions, not necessarily limited to transportation alone, because there are many multi-state operations in other fields of activity, and transportation might benefit by taking a broader look. You'll notice some overlap between my presentation and Mr. Williamson's presentation. These are two projects that were going on at the same time, but essentially independently. I think it's interesting that we independently came up with a lot of the same ideas, and so that verifies that we're on the right track, I think. My white paper has been developed starting around February, and should be available within a month or less, I hope. We're just making some final revisions and just about to get it out. Doesn't have to go through the long process the TRB uses, and so we will send it to each of you and also distribute it more broadly. As a part of putting this paper together, we held a national roundtable with about 20 experts from across the country on June 18th in Washington, D.C., and got a lot of additional ideas and some refinement of what was in the paper. So we are trying to include that before we wrap up the final version of the paper. As Ed explained, there's no magic here. I think the thing that is felt to be most lacking by the 20 or so corridor coalitions that have been put together is that they go through a lot of convening. They sponsor studies, they make some recommendations, and then where do they go? At that point, they're sort of into the cajoling the existing actors, most of which are not multi-state, and so it's a sort of where do we go with implementing the multi-state portions of their recommendations. I think they feel kind of inadequate to do that, both in terms of implementing and getting results on a broad scale for a whole corridor. There's nobody in charge of a corridor, basically. Should there be? If there is to be, then what form would that take? And so the question is, can we do a better job than working just with what we have at the moment institutionally? So the paper offers three things. Okay. Oh, I see. Yeah, I kind of forgot from the practice session. There's the error. So the paper offers three key things. First, it identifies seven key capabilities that are needed to improve performance in multi-state transportation corridors, and I'll outline those in a minute. Essentially, this is the question of what needs to be done. Second, it says a survey, but I want to change that to a scan of cross-border institutions, and we came up with eight types. You'll notice when I get to explaining those, there's some similarity with those that Mr. Williamson just went through. And I looked at about 80 illustrative examples. I did not do case studies. This was not an evaluation, but simply an identification. Many of the organizations, however, are ones that I've known for years and have followed over my career. And so I've pulled together out of my experience and out of current resources to take a look at those and put them in piles of similarity and see what we could learn from them. And then third, some considerations or criteria for deciding which of these institutional options might be the most helpful in any given multi-state transportation corridor. And I will go into each of these three topics now. I want to reemphasize, as Ed did, that we made no recommendations. That was part of the deal going in. But we want to have information in front of the whole community available so that you're not going to overlook some possibilities when you're dealing with these tough institutional questions. The institutional questions usually are the toughest ones you find. So we outlined seven key capabilities that are necessary to improve the operations, the performance of a multi-state freight corridor. The first two, I think there's a growing consensus on that we need multi-state scope and multimodal scope together, and we seldom get that in a single organization. Strategic planning and goal setting, essentially that's the public policy part of this. And therefore, this capability needs to center primarily in public institutions of one sort or another, not necessarily a single agency, but something that is recognized in law and legitimized as a public policy-making organization. Then next, the system management to achieve improved outcomes. And what I mean by an outcome is something that actually makes a difference to people, not simply something that you were accountable for doing and did it. But this is the make a difference part. I'll just illustrate that very quickly. All of you, I'm sure, are quite familiar with the just-in-time nature of our transportation system now, where something may be on the shelf of a retail organization on a day that is advertised in the newspapers ahead of time, and it's not actually on the shelf when it's advertised, or when you sign the contract for the advertising to be done. And this comes from many countries away, many thousands of miles, natural resources processed into raw materials and manufactured into something in a far-off country, and then a long chain of transportation logistics to get it on that store shelf early in the morning before the doors open for the advertised sale. So this is a very intricate kind of system, but that's what makes a difference, whether the stuff is actually on the shelf. And that's the performance of the freight corridor. If the freight corridor is not really performing, some of those things aren't going to be on the shelf, and you're going to have to get a rain check. So maybe that's awfully simple, but that's what we're talking about in terms of performance outcomes. This one that is kind of a light green, number three, implementation of the projects and operational improvements. This is hard to do if it's actually a multi-state project, because there aren't that many multi-state institutions. The one that obviously comes to mind is the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which really does have some pretty strong operating powers and does operate across state boundaries. But more than likely, what you would really like to do is under the jurisdiction of individual state DOTs or other individual agencies that do not cross state boundaries. The strong and reliable financing, this is where more project battles are lost than anywhere else. No financing, no implementation, no performance improvement, and the public policy does not get implemented. So it's a chain, and I don't have to tell you, now that we're in recession, that times are tough and money is hard to get. I've done a lot of work in the Chesapeake Bay, which has been recognized since the early 70s as being way over polluted. Something needs to be done about it. In 1983, finally, they put together a multi-state coordinating group to do something about it, and it's been working hard and diligently, and the bay continues to get worse. And so somebody says, what's going on here? Well, I think you have the same situation with freight, and if the growth in freight is going to be as strong as the projections are, we need to do better institutionally, or we're not going to get there. In the Chesapeake Bay, one of the reasons it's not working is they're getting about 10% of what they figure they need in terms of financing. And then this bottom one may seem a little strange to you, but the ease of establishment of the institution. It is really important to be able to get the institution. Otherwise, you sort of have nowhere to go. But if you have an institution, then you can build upon it and you can gradually strengthen it. So I would say out of all of these that getting the institution established is probably your number one priority. So let's take a look then at what the institutional options are, these eight options that I mentioned earlier. Interstate compacts, and under each of these I give a few illustrations of primarily transportation ones that you will recognize and resonate with. You'll know immediately what I'm talking about, and that's why I picked them for a transportation audience. There are a few in here that are not transportation, but let me just read across the eight. The Interstate Compact, the Joint Services Agreement, like they have in the Alameda Corridor, the Special District or Authority, California High-Speed Rail is an example. Voluntary coalitions, 20 or so transportation corridor coalitions, the MPOs, well-known, 384 of those, and about 22 of those actually are interstate. And then there's a new crop of these things coming along that's been getting started in recent years, the Regional Rural Transportation Planning Organization, which are forming in more and more states. Several states have gone to this as a general practice, but it's not national yet. Essentially putting together an MPO in areas of smaller population than metro. And a lot of the freight problems come up in rural areas. The farm to market, I mean, the reason the feds got into highways to start with was the rural roads were so bad they couldn't get food to market, believe it or not. And that's where the highway program began. So I think we cannot ignore the regional aspect at the rural or less than metro level. Nonprofit corporations, take a minute just to highlight a couple of these that you're not familiar with, but it's the sort of thing that TRB is, and you're very familiar with that. And I happen to be sitting in the offices right now of the Intelligent Transportation Society of America, where I'm working on a very interesting project. But these other two that I've put in here have, I think, something to teach us in transportation. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation was established by Congress a couple decades ago because so much of our fish and wildlife work at the federal level, and when you get into state, it's mirrored by the same kind of stovepipes, is split between the Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA, and NOAA. And so this organization was set up to pool funds from those three. It's also authorized to accept and use congressional appropriations and essentially leverage these public funds with nonprofit or foundation funds to tackle problems that are larger than any individual funding source has. And so that's kind of an interesting approach. I don't know of any others that are quite like it, but that's a possibility for transportation funds, which come from many, many different programs. The North American Electrical Reliability Corporation is pretty interesting. I was very surprised to run across this. You will recall a number of years ago that the Northeast part of the nation, most notably New York City, but extending even into Canada, had a real serious blackout. And then more recently, about a decade ago or so, there were huge problems on the West Coast. The whole West Coast, but most notably California, when electrical power was not adequate. The grid could not supply the needs of those areas all along that coast. And so we had major problem. There was a national study as a result of those incidents. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission established electrical reliability standards for the network. And interestingly enough, they gave compliance authority with those regulations to the North American Electrical Reliability Corporation, which is a nonprofit incorporated in the state of New Jersey. It is also developing relationships with, I think, two of the Canadian provinces to bring all of those together so that it can be not just multi-state, national, but international. And so what that illustrates, I think, is the value of nonprofits in being able to be borderless if it gets agreement from the various parties to act on their behalf. I won't comment on the commercial companies. You're familiar with the railroads and the truckers and et cetera. And you're probably pretty familiar with the federal corporations have some interesting little descriptions of how Conrail was established to take over from the failing freight operations of the private railroads in the Northeast, pulled them together, rationalized them, and sold them off in about 20 years as profitable operations. Amtrak took over from the exit by all of the railroads in the nation from the passenger rail service. So we've made some rather major institutional decisions in this country in times of crisis. And so the message I get from that is don't think it's impossible. If the crisis is there and can be articulated, you can probably get the institutions you need, but it may have to wait for the right moment. And then we've had a variety of federal agencies over time, the Office of High-Speed Ground Transportation in the 60s, which began to lay the groundwork for the Metro liners and then later Acela on the East Coast. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers does all the waterways and ports stuff, which has a strong relationship to that supply chain. And the Appalachian Regional Commission had as its primary program a whole new highway system for that underserved part of the nation to tie it into the interstate system. And it's 90% or more complete over a period of some 30 to 40 years. So we've got some real success stories out there. Some are huge, some are smaller. But these are the kinds of things that are illustrated briefly in my paper. So a couple of conclusions, if I can find the right arrow. No single institution might be what you're looking for. Each may have an important contribution to make. So the institutional question is probably going to be answered not by a single organization, but by, you might say, an institutional ecological network. I'm a kind of a visual person, not everybody is, but these are the same eight institutional forms, and each one is a glass, which sometimes is fairly empty, but here are the typical combinations of the capabilities. You remember those seven capabilities from a couple slides ago. These are the kinds of capabilities you might expect to find more or less typically in each of these institutional organizations. The Interstate Compact, if done right, can have everything in it. It can also have almost nothing in it. For example, one of the things we ran into was Midwest Passenger Rail Interstate Compact. I think it's something like 14 states. It's quite a few. And it essentially is a promotional organization for the idea of passenger rail tying Chicago, Detroit, and some of the other major Midwestern hubs together in a much improved passenger rail setup. So it's only got one of these layers in it, the strategic public policies. It's really not even quite that in a robust way, but it does do the studies, it promotes the idea, and it gets those ideas on the table. And you can go all the way from there to something that can finance, implement, and do the whole work if you have the right kind of legislation. The big problem with it is it's very hard to do institutionally. And you'll notice the ease of establishment is not there. So you're not likely to have these things very often. Joint services agreement, nothing special there. You have to, everybody have been lined up ahead of time on what the policy is, and then these guys just go do it on special order. Special districts and authorities are somewhat the same way. I think the it's interesting to look at these voluntary coalitions. They have the policy making, they have the range geographically, they have the range modally, and they're pretty easy to establish, but they don't have some of the other layers of getting it done. If you look right below that, the federal agency, or next to it, the federal corporations, they have a good deal of implementation authority if they are established with it. And sometimes that's a big if. There's also a major governance issue in those agencies. People are afraid of big government, and so they often don't give a lot of discretion to a federal organization. They want to make sure that it doesn't take over. And of course, the states are very concerned about that, because a lot of what's in the transportation portfolio is traditionally state. The commercial and the nonprofit are relatively limited in what they can do, but they can do it very well. So that's kind of a rundown where we combine the capabilities analysis with the institutional analysis and give you sort of a reality check on what you might be able to expect. I want to say that don't take any of these glasses as a given. You have to go and you have to fill up the glass with the capabilities in legislation and in hard work institutionally. So the task ahead is to select the most appropriate glasses for meeting your specific corridor's needs. And that means you have to be really sure about what your needs are. I think that was a major conclusion that the Williamson study came to as well. And then work like hell to fill each of the glasses with as many capabilities as you will need to meet your purposes. So, here are some key considerations for selecting the appropriate institutional options. You might call these institutional design principles. Form follows function, or I could say purpose. Be very, very clear about the purposes for which you're trying to set up an institution, and get people to buy into that and agree to it. Otherwise, you're not likely to get it. Number two, I've already mentioned, no single institution necessarily is what you're looking for, but a combination that can work together. The third conclusion here, look to existing organizations first define and utilize the capabilities that they have and satisfy the need for institutional capabilities. The reason I emphasize this one as much as I do is that you ignore these existing institutions at your own peril. This is a turf question. You don't take them in somehow. They're going to be opponents. And the last thing you need in multi-state is opponents. You have enough natural opposition to the idea of doing things multi-state as you need without creating any more. And then make sure you tailor this institution specifically to the time and place within your region or whatever the multi-state grouping is. If you look across the country, there have been a lot of stories done on this about how political and other cultures differ from one part of the country to another. What's going to work in one part of the country may not work in another, and you have to be very sensitive to the time and place in which you're trying to put these organizations together. The most important capability sought is boundary crossing. If you get everything else and you can't cross the boundary, then you're not doing what my study is about. So, the next slide just sort of summarizes this all on a table. I won't go into this in detail. It's all the stuff I've already talked about. But how it's organized, essentially, is down the left-hand side, you have those eight types of institutions, in other words, the glasses. You go across, you get some examples of each. When is it appropriate? And then we put two things in there. One is who takes the lead, state people, local people, innovators of various types, special interests, private people, federal, and so on. And specifically, what kind of a situation would each be most useful in? And then you can see the red, yellow, green on a lot of this is how hard it's going to be to do and what you can naturally expect from that type of organization for this type of function you want to fill across those four types. So those are roughly combinations of the seven capabilities. So that's what you have, essentially sort of end up with a matrix of choices, a little bit of thinking about how you would make those choices. And I hope this will be helpful to the community as you try to deal with the institutional challenges that you come across in each part of the country. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bruce, and thank you, Ed, for the introduction to Bruce's presentation. We're now going to move on to our final presentation given by David Seltzer of Mercator Advisors. So, David, I will go ahead and turn it over to you.
Well, thanks, Jennifer. And the institutional arrangements that I'll be briskly walking through deal with establishing a national freight infrastructure bank. So, unlike Bruce and Mike's presentation, much of which centered around the institutional design of project sponsors and planning operational construction issues, we're going to be surveying the financing end of freight projects and specifically looking from the federal perspective. And this PowerPoint is really a condensation of some work that we had done the end of last year for the I-95 Corridor Coalition. As many of you know, that's a partnership of state DOTs and regional and local transportation agencies of all modes, spanning from Maine to Florida, and I guess beyond, designed to enhance both passenger and freight movement throughout the corridor. The other factors that are in the background are some recent legislative initiatives in Washington that have been introduced dealing with, in one form or another, some type of new financial institution, a national infrastructure bank or infrastructure development corp, including in the president's 2010 budget, where there is a $2 billion FY 2010 request for capitalizing the first year of a federal infrastructure bank. I'm not going to dwell on the freight project categorization other than to say that if a project is a hub, intermodal or intramodal, or a long distance corridor, dozens or hundreds of miles, or that last mile connector, the fact is that there's a wide array of different goods movement projects, and they have different mixes of public benefits and private benefits, and those in turn lead to different funding strategies, financing techniques, and, as Bruce and Mike pointed out, institutional arrangements. That really underscores the need for various forms of federal assistance, if we're talking about a federal discretionary program for large freight projects, not just a one form of federal assistance. And many of us are aware of why public funding for freight at all levels, federal, state, and local, has been limited. The fact that much of it, and particularly rail, freight rail, is privately owned. The eligibility issues associated with intermodal uses straddling current federal programs. Projects, particularly corridor projects, spanning those political jurisdictions that Bruce was alluding to, especially where public support's required. And the spillover benefit, the externalities that are hard to measure and even harder to monetize or transform into cash. All of those have led to a dearth of funding for freight. I think in Safety Lou, something under 2% of the grants are really designated for freight programs. But we need to ask ourselves, what's the problem that we're trying to solve with these large freight projects? Is it that financing is either too expensive or, as we've seen in the last year, perhaps unavailable at any price for these freight projects? That would suggest that the objective of this new federal institution should be to overcome the capital market's failure through either some sort of credit assistance, loans, or perhaps financing subsidies in the form of tax code incentives. Or is it more fundamental than that? A lack of underlying revenue streams attached to those projects, insufficient funding, particularly where there are public benefits that don't result in necessarily extracting a revenue stream from users. In addition, we have superimposed in all this the question of whether our focus should be near-term stimulus measures. I heard someone the other day refer to the recovery bill as we now have a national sidewalk policy. You know, the projects can be most readily implemented, or is it really a longer-term perspective, ones that are more complicated, may have greater benefits, but much more difficult to kickstart? So in terms of why there should be a new federal program, the literature focuses, and certainly I-95 Corridor Coalition has noted that these are projects whose magnitude and complexity often exceed the financial or institutional capacity of state and local governments. There are the aforenoted gaps in federal aid eligibility. The benefit of providing a bundle of different programs in one office so that the project sponsors have one-stop shopping for the various needs of the major goods movement investments. Also targeting those projects, of course, that have the largest economic benefit. And then another factor, this was pointed out by the Bipartisan Policy Center in their recent study, is to enhance the quality of project selection at the federal level, really focusing more on outcomes and not nodal decisions. So if we acknowledge that there's a need for a federal program, why create a new organization, a new special purpose entity, SPE? Why not just do it through existing DOT organizational structures? And many observers have felt that there could be a benefit in terms of an independent board that has autonomy and expertise that could help lead to that improved project selection. If there's going to be, secondly, a new revenue stream, there could be value to aligning an organization specifically to that dedicated revenue stream to help stimulate capital investment, the one-stop shopping, and then lastly, perhaps a new program for large freight projects could take pressure off of or remove competition from the existing and continuing formula-funded programs by really targeting those largest projects. Now here the question is really, again, looking at the financing end, why not authorize states to create their own regional, I'll call them financing entities, not project sponsors, which should be done at the state or regional or local level, but at the financial assistance level. And there's several arguments for that, starting with the fact that if projects have national benefits, there should be some sort of organization that has national responsibility for advancing them. The very scope of the projects suggests that a single nationwide entity could bring scale economies and avoid duplicative efforts that would have to be done at the regional level. We've seen the fact that there's varying degrees of success with the state infrastructure banks. And then significantly, allowing access to direct federal credit support that offers a lower cost source of financing and greater budgetary efficiency than state or local levels. Finally, the fact the federal tax code can be a powerful, powerful tool for stimulating investment. I'm going to briefly just note that our own thinking was informed by AASHTO's freight authorization policy. You'll see in bold font there, AASHTO had proposed, in addition to $21 billion in formula funding, $21 billion in discretionary allocations, roughly $3.5 billion a year on average, that might be funded from any one of a number of different sources. And it's that $21 billion of discretionary funding that we really looked at how it might be utilized. We also looked at, and this is something I believe that CBO initially identified, this diagram of different organizational templates for a federally initiated special purpose entity, ranging from the most federal, starting on the left with the existing modal agencies of DOT, all the way to a purely privatized approach on the right. You'll see that we centered on the second column from the left, some sort of federally chartered government corporation that would have features of a commercial enterprise, but also would be an on-budget entity. And these aren't just formalistic decisions, they have important budgetary implications, what the fiscal architecture, if you will, of the entity is. Specifically as concerns the budgetary scoring of this freight infrastructure bank's borrowing and spending activities. And the U.S. Treasury Department is always concerned about cost effectiveness of other organizations borrowing in the capital markets. In the wake of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's struggles, implied federal responsibility for the debt of a new special purpose entity, and indeed competition with the Treasury's own not insignificant borrowing needs. So this diagram here, this is what I'll call the money shot. In the light font is the hollow boxes on the left are existing or proposed formula programs to the states that would still play a major role in advancing goods movement projects. The shaded boxes on the right are for this new discretionary program, a National Freight Infrastructure Bank, and essentially offering three different product lines. First, we think most projects will still need some form of grant, so there'll be a large discretionary grant component of its activities. And indeed, we call this a bank, but it's not your typical financial lending institution. It's really predominantly going to be a grant dispensing entity as we envisaged it. The second box in sort of yellow or ochre would be a lending program, a federal program, credit program, similar to the TIFIA and RIF programs that many of you are familiar with. Then the third function would be building upon an existing DOT authorization to allocate tax incentives in the form of tax advantage debt. We're thinking not just the private activity PAB volume, as is currently the case with the highway and intermodal program at USDOT, but also something called tax credit bonds. There were some 30 to 35 billion of new tax credit bonds authorized in February with the recovery bill. And this entity would not be an issuer of those bonds, but could designate which project sponsors, public and private, would have responsibility. So this freight infrastructure bank would, if it had $3.5 billion a year, perhaps 85% of it, $3 billion a year, might go for grants. A half a billion could be used for credit, but because of the fractional scoring or budgetary charge for loans for credit, half a billion dollars per year might support $5 billion face amount of loans, similar to the TIFIA program. And then a third component would be allocating the tax-advantaged bonds, tax credit bonds, where the federal government pays all the interest, or tax-exempt private activity bonds. So finally, there are some other open issues, starting with whether this multi-purpose entity, the bank, should be confined to advancing freight projects or also handle that other sector or mode that hasn't had access to dedicated funding up until the recovery bill, and that's intercity passenger rail, and indeed other major surface transportation projects that assist freight. Should the existing TIFIA and RIF programs be consolidated into this new bank? Should it be part of safety leave reauthorization or a new stimulus bill? And should it, like the President's infrastructure bank proposal, be general fund funded or highway trust fund funded? And one can argue the broader the reach and the more the externalities, public benefits of this, the stronger the argument for general fund funding. So with that, we'll turn it over to Jennifer.